Now, we are joined on the programme by Nat O'Connor, Policy Specialist with Age Action. Nat, good to have you back on the show. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Right, okay. Now, there's a warning out there about family members who use next of kin status to swindle older people's money. A senior social worker for the Cork and Kerry region has warned of disgusting financial abuse of elderly patients by family members who use next of kin status to swindle their money. Now, this is someone who's spoken out from the Cork and Kerry region, but I presume it's not exclusive to that region. Is this something that Age Action is familiar with?
Unfortunately so. And, you know, the issue here is this is not an uncommon occurrence. We know from the latest HSC report that over 850 cases of financial abuse of older persons were reported. And those are just the reported cases. And more than half of them affected an older person aged 80 or older. And, of course, it's happening all around the country. So, unfortunately, while it's not most people's experience, there's hundreds of cases happening every year, and it's certainly an issue for national concern that this is happening. And, you know, you said yourself at the outset, people are abusing next of kin status. There's no such thing in law as being next of kin. It has no legal power. Now, if you're married to someone, if you're the spouse, then you have certain legal rights. But other than that, you know, this term has been abused, and unfortunately it's still used sometimes in, you know, nursing home application forms and the like. It just means who to contact. It doesn't give you any rights to come in and make decisions on behalf of an older person.
In one case, a relative of an older person who was sick in hospital sent in a solicitor to have a will changed at the hospital bedside when the patient was suffering from a progressive illness. Now, that is shocking on so many levels. But did that person do anything legally wrong? Although clearly there is moral questions to be asked there.
Well, the issue there would be, you know, would any court uphold such a will? You know, is there a solicitor involved who's going to be, you know, verifying that will or, you know, registering it? Because if somebody is making a will under duress, or if they're affected by dementia and they're not able to, you know, make decisions at that time, then certainly that would not be a valid will. But it's very serious that such a thing should happen. And I mean, there are steps we can take. I mean, part of Age Action's concern is that we don't have all the legal protection in place that we should have. For example, coercive control is recognized in law in a marriage or in an intimate relationship where somebody might be essentially bullying or psychologically pushing someone into doing something that they don't really want to do. But we don't recognize that in law when it's an older person affected. So we need to bring that into law, widen the definition. And likewise, we need an adult safeguarding law. At the moment, the HSC has a national safeguarding team, but it's based on guidelines. We want to see legal obligations so that there can be no grey lines and no confusion about this kind of next of kin business.
Yeah, because it doesn't have to be happening widespread. It's happening all too often, but it doesn't have to be widespread for it to, I don't know how you describe it, but just a worry for an older person. Do you know what I mean? That something like this could happen to them when... I mean, an older person can come out of hospital, you know, perfectly fine and live a healthy life for some time to come, but can be really quite disorientated in a hospital setting, for an example, where it could be exploited. You know what I mean? Like, I just don't want older people to have any further things to have to worry about. God knows society's set up to make their life difficult enough as is without this sort of emotional worry.
Absolutely. I mean, certainly... You know, there's over 180,000 people in Ireland aged 80 and older. And happily, most of them are living independently at home, you know, aging in place in their homes and communities, which is what most of us want. But at any point in time, there are about 30,000 people in nursing homes or other residential care. And it's there where, particularly if someone's affected by dementia or other cognitive issues, that there's a particular vulnerability. And it is only a minority of cases. But unfortunately, it's a case that people are being... abused in that context, financially abused, psychologically abused. And unfortunately, it's mostly family members and sometimes the wider family who get involved. And this is to do with an assumption that some people seem to have that they have a right to inheritance. And the law does not recognize a right to inheritance, except again, for your husband or wife or for your children and even then, not in every circumstance. So when a wider family is getting involved and saying, oh, well, I'm the only surviving relative, this is just someone seeking, unfortunately, to line their own pockets. And that's something I think as a society we have to take on, because unfortunately, we know that people are not reporting issues like this because it's inside the family.
Yeah,
they don't want to get the guards involved. So, they don't want to make a fuss.
You talked about how you talked about, you know, in the healthcare setting, the majority are living independently at home, but they probably still have someone calling around that's constantly at them, or, you know, emotional blackmail or coercion or whatever it might be. If someone listening is in that position, whereby someone is, you know, consistently calling around or called around once and trying to influence them or guilt them or, as I say, emotionally blackmail or whatever it might be to write a will, they should have a will, of course, but or to adjust a will, you know, what should someone do in that situation? I would say there's quite a few people listening to this program that say, you know what, I can kind of identify with that.
Well, there's a number of things. I mean, I can give you the number, for example, of the HSE's National Safeguarding Office, which is on 061-461-165. And likewise, Age Action has an information helpline on 01-475-6989. And there's other numbers people can call. And indeed, if somebody is stealing your money, so for example, if someone's doing the shopping for you and you're giving them the bank card and, you know, you check your balance and there's just sums are missing, or there's items on the receipt that were not for you, that were for them, that's theft. And if you're not in a position to have that conversation directly with somebody because you need them to do your groceries or whatever, do get in contact with a third party, whether it's Age Action or the HSC or even the Gardaí, who will give you advice on what you can do in those circumstances. Because, you know, the risk is that you'd let something slide and that, you know, these things can escalate. So somebody might be doing your shopping and you think, ah, sure, they put petrol in the car, so that's only fair, it's something for them. But if it grows and grows and becomes abusive, then we have to say no, you know, the older person.
And you have to ask yourself, you know, someone might say, well, I don't want to lose them from my life for all their failings. But you do have to ask yourself, is that person worth having around you if that's what they think of you, that they might try and convince you one way or other of something, or they might be, you know, exploiting you financially as well. Before I let you go, Nat, the GEA Go conversation has raised its head again, and it affects older people in my mind to a great extent. It's now going to cost, you know, €79 for people to watch 30-odd games on GEA Go. Obviously, it's a condensed season now. There's a lot of games. The GEA argue that if they didn't have this service, the games wouldn't be there. But again, older people more likely to use cash. If they go and want to watch a game in person, they can't pay cash. They might not have access to the internet. I think, 3 in 10 older people don't have access even to the internet to watch GEA games. Now, the GEA clearly is a business, okay? But it is also of the community and supported by the community and supported really quite healthily. 25 mil, 50 mil in total, I believe, last year by the state. Have you any concerns, Age Action, any concerns of the way even something as important as the GEA seems to be sidelining older people, that they don't seem important?
Well, you've put your finger on it and you've really spelled it out. I mean, as a society, we spend millions every year to support arts, culture and sport. And part of the deal has to be inclusion to make sure nobody is left behind. And as you say, 3 in 10 older persons don't use the internet at all. And another 3 in 10 who do use the internet have below basic skills. And this is according to regular surveys done by the CSO.
We're into the majority now.
So the majority would have a difficulty with online. And of course, it's not just the subscription cost of the GEA Go, which is reasonable. But if you don't have a digital device, buying of that, buying a broadband subscription, you know, you have to update devices and other software. It's expensive.
It's complicated to get on a telly as well. It is complicated. You know what I mean? It's not really as simple as perhaps it should be.
So there's a lot of barriers there, which we call invisible barriers. And our concern is, you know, the organizations involved, which includes the GAA and RTE, need to make sure there's a pathway there. If an older person wants to learn digital skills, you know, more programs are needed to help people take that step. And at the same time, if people can't use a GEA Go, we have to make sure that the premium matches that people really want to see are available on the television in a normal way.
You see, the government is prepared to withdraw funding in terms of, say, for instance, gender balance on the board of a sporting authority. So they are prepared to say, right, you know, we're not going to give you this money until such time as we see a bit better representation of gender. Yet it seems, to some extent, the GEA is a law into itself that we will chuck the 24, 50 odd million at them annually, but there's nothing coming back in return to say, hold on, yet we need to come up with a business plan that is inclusive, that's inclusive of the people who perhaps maybe made the GEA what it is today in terms of, you know, cash at the turnstile, in terms of being able to watch the big games. It's like, I just think those people need advocacy at the highest level in government. I think they need more advocacy. That's all I'm saying, really. Maybe that's an opinion, but I don't mind expressing that
entirely.
Opinion.
And you put your finger on it. And the issue about the cashless is important because people say, sure, why can't you tap? You have a bank card. But if you're not using the internet, you can't check your balance online. And we know more than half of older people rely on social protection for more than half of their income. So most are on low fixed incomes where you're minding your money, you're minding it through cash. And exactly as you say, if you want to go pay cash at a turnstile, and certainly from Age Action's perspective, we think every match, there should be at least one gate where you can pay cash. And there's all these workarounds where you can go to certain shops.
But the great PR of it, like, PR of it, say, do you know what? We really value the older community, and with that in mind, we are providing one cash turnstile because we love them, we care about them, they're in our community, they built our organisation. That's, can you imagine the positive PR from that? It's wonderful. Now, apparently, you can actually pay cash at league games, believe it or not, but anyway, it's not advertised, but we'll not get into that. Last question to you. It's specific. I know you can't get into specifics, so let's pretend this is a general inquiry. I'm listening to Nat there talking about elder abuse. Can you ask him, what do we do as the same thing happened to our relative in a nursing home? A relative broke into their home, reported to the guards, but they wouldn't help us. They said it was a civil matter. The person changed the locks and put their name on the ESB meter. Our relative has advanced dementia. So they're in the care setting, and a relative has broken into the home, changed the locks, change the electricity into their name. Gardaí won't get involved. They believe it's a civil matter. I understand it's going to be difficult for you to comment on this because it's kind of a specific case. But what would your general input be there?
As a generic case, if somebody has no entitlement to be in your home. So, for example, if I'm an older person, my adult child has no entitlement to live in my house.
Who can advocate on behalf of the older person with advanced dementia?
So, I mean, there's lots of options there. I mean, organisations such as SAGE Advocacy can offer individual, you know, support for a person. Likewise, I would be going back to the guards and saying, no, hang on, or going to a solicitor and looking at this, because it may be a family matter. But if the person has no right to be in a house, and certainly no right to be changing locks or changing bills, that is theft. And it's, you know, on a fairly hefty scale. Mm. And so that would need to be investigated. And if the person, for example, is in line to inherit a house, they don't own it until probate and the whole legal process. You know, they have no entitlement to use a property that they, in their mind, think that they're going to inherit. Quite the contrary.
All right,
if somebody commits a crime, they can root themselves out of inheritance as far as the courts are concerned. They can lose any right the court might have given them to inheritance if they commit crime. So there's a lot in this, but certainly, you know, I wouldn't be taking it lying down. In terms of, you know, wider family who may be concerned at something they're seeing unfold.
Nat, as always, it's great having you on the show. I do enjoy it. Thanks for your time today again.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye. Nat O'Connor, Policy Specialist with Age Action. Stephanie Regan, Clinical Psychotherapist. A very good morning to you, Stephanie.
How are you?
I am doing fantastic and really pleased to be speaking to you. And it's off the back of a survey which tells us that just over half of women report stress during the Christmas period. What are the triggers for these stresses, Stephanie?
Well, the article that I wrote, which I think you're referring to, is the, I suppose that I find perfectionism drives a lot of stress, but there are many other stresses. The one I was speaking about especially was perfectionism and how that desire to have everything controlled, to have everything super organized, super complete, leaving nothing to doubt, How it really drives stress into an already quite stressful situation, you know, because people, what happens then is people find themselves focused on all the wrong things. You know, they're focused, instead of being focused on the crack and the fun and the joy and just the niceness of doing and the act of doing, if you like, doing up the house, making the, you know, making the food that you don't normally do and all of those things. If you put yourself into the perfection mode, you find yourself just focusing on all the things you're doing wrong and all the things that aren't perfect and what's not done instead of what is done. So that was why I focused on that. But there's loads of other stresses.
Of course, you differentiate between perfectionism and achievement.
Yes, absolutely. Because the person, I mean, we all do strive to have nice Christmases, you know, and we all have little pictures in our mind about how that looks. But for most people, they're able to do their best and kind of draw a line there and say, well, you know, it's pretty good, but I'm pretty exhausted now, so I'm going to put my feet up. But so having good high standards is absolutely fine. But if you're finding yourself not enjoying it, even though you've got a lot done, you're probably in the perfectionistic situation.
And you say that sometimes this can be quite deeply rooted in your past.
Yeah, perfectionism tends to be very associated with anxiety, with and other kind of, you know, obsessive compulsive disorders, all of that is kind of, it's attached to that. But in clinical terms, we would usually go to the root of things, because that's obviously what therapy is about. And we try and find, what is it that you are soothing in yourself by keeping everything perfect, keeping everything under control, keeping things without doubt and without risk, if you like, of it going wrong. So you do everything and then you don't have to rely on everyone. And we find that in broad terms, that tends to go back to childhood. It may be a chaotic household. It may be obviously addiction. We know how much addiction there is around us all in life. And that causes dysfunctionality. It also causes a lot of children's needs not being met. Children, as I say, parenting parents, where they're looking out for them. And these are the things that spike anxiety, not in all children, but we all have different little tendencies. Some become aggressive, some become, you know, withdrawn, some become shy, some become no trouble. So there's a whole load of ways to defend yourself against that, but perfectionism is one of them.
Yes, and I like the suggestion you make as to how you might sort of address that. Obviously, you know, as you say, through counselling and what have you, you know, people can tease that stuff out, but you can begin that journey yourself really by, because it is Christmas, writing a letter to Santa yourself and reflecting. Writing stuff down, it really because you often see it when people write books, don't you? And you talk about that question, was it cathartic? You know, and it always is, right? Because it's the first question you ask someone who's written a book. But the reason that question pops up is because it can be very helpful, because you are not forced, but you think about things that you don't necessarily think in your mind or even that you might say to somebody.
Yeah, it draws it up. You're absolutely right. It draws it up and it draws up memories and it attaches one thing to the other. And it also makes you focus a little on the detail. And, you know, it's the essence of therapy. When you say something, the emotion is attached. But equally, you know, when you sometimes just say it out loud, you can feel yourself sort of welling up about something that you weren't even sure you were going to well up about before. And that's why we always say to people at emotional times, practice your speech, say it out loud, because whatever emotion is attached, it will pop up. When you write things down, it does the same thing. Mm-hmm. Not exactly the same, but in a very close sort of connection to that. And it's very therapeutic. So I often say to people, let's just try and find out what's going on here. And a simple way for yourself, as you say, we don't all need therapy. We're not, and I'm not plugging that in any way. But I think it's really useful. If you let the child in yourself speak, dear Santa, this is how it was for me. And you start to say those words, because I always think letters are quite emotional. I think it's the child in us all. We were all taught to write letters. So when we say, dear anybody, we feel quite close to them. And I think that by just connecting with that part of you that was happy or sad or disappointed or tense, you know, you will hear people will often tell me the tension of Christmas comes back to them. They didn't know what was going to happen, who was going to come in the door, how was mother going to be, where was her mood, where was his mood. And these are little small people trying to navigate that. But in every man and woman today, there is a small person there.
And that's, I think that's just the letter to Santa actually is very clever, because it immediately disarms you. You have to go back to that space even more so. In fact, if you were writing letters at any time of the year, maybe it might be good to write them to Santa. How do you, a partner or someone else in the house, assist someone who is a perfectionist like this? Because they can often be really quite controlling, and the only way they can achieve their perfectionism is if they do it all themselves, if they have full control out of it, if no one has their dirty, sticky fingerprints, metaphorically speaking, over it. So how do you then sort of assist them? You know, because the easiest thing would be to say, it's not fun, have a bit of fun. But that's like telling someone with anxiety to pull themselves together. It's not helpful. So how do we support these people?
Yeah, that's very insightful of you, I have to say. I think that's exactly, you've put your finger just exactly on it. How do you support them? First of all, it's important to remember that if you're perfectionistic, you're also slightly excluding your partner. So it's kind of hard for them to come into you, as you say, and help you out there. So they feel cut out and a bit helpless. And I know it's easy to say, oh, well, you let her do all the work, or you let him do all the work. But really, deep down, there's an unhappiness in it. So you can reach out to them. I suggest to people that before the time comes upon you in a total way and takes over all your thinking, that you might just say to yourself, allocate one task to everybody beforehand. That means that's going to be someone else's responsibility. Now, I know it's difficult. You have to sit with the discomfort a little, but this is how you help yourself. The other is that you promise yourself that you will always sit before the job is done, not after the job is done. So again, you're teaching yourself and your impulse to slow down the process. It's not you're not operating as completely unconsciously. And the other is, of course, that you acknowledge that, as I say, you get in the Santa letter, what does Christmas do to me? And acknowledge that. Say it to yourself. I'm tense because it's Christmas, but that's an old feeling. Now, this is a new Christmas with my husband, my children, or, you know, my friends. This is a new time, and I don't have to bring it with me fully. So I'm going to try and forget that. I'm going to try and let that go into the past. Now, it's a process. I'm not saying it's a click your fingers, but these are the things that help.
Is it possible, too, that in some cases this is avoidance? You know, that maybe it's a difficult time of year for some people, and no matter how perfect they got it, they couldn't be happy. And really, this is to avoid something else in their life that they're not dealing with. Is that possible in some cases?
Well, I think, you know, hyper-busyness can be a defence, which is, you could say it's in that. The perfectionism, I think, has a unique kind of character to it. But you will often see people who, yes, they sort of hide in business, don't you? You know, you can see times, and it may be a good defense, you know, being busy at Christmas and get all involved and get up to your eyes in it all. And it may be a good defense and a good help to the person against maybe loneliness or grief or whatever. So some defenses are very positive for us and they help us forward, but there are others that kind of destroy our life a little bit. And I think it's not so much choosing the right one as acknowledging which one is operating.
Okay.
And why.
So we have to remember, for those who are in a position to be happy and what have you, because obviously people listening, you know, for different reasons they may not be. But if everything is all right, you can't forget what Christmas is about. Either it is an opportunity maybe to relax a little bit, to form memories that you can bank memories for times to come. Mend the bridges perhaps. No one wants to sort of have any regrets if someone passes away or what have you. But ultimately to allow yourself space to be happy or even content.
Mm-hmm. I think what you're touching on there is, and of course there's so much in Christmas, I find I look at it from so many angles, and you know, the, as you say, to mend bridges, there can be a very big pressure on people to mend bridges at Christmas, and that can be tricky for people. And like you, I agree, it's an opportunity just to, you know, put a good wish to somebody that maybe you haven't been in touch with. But sometimes people stay out of touch with people for good reasons.
Oh, yes, for sure. I get that. Yep.
Yeah, and there can be a lot of pressure, you know, to kind of drop that and get back.
Well, we could start the whole conversation about Christmas dinner around at mum's or something. You know, or a family party, I get you. Okay, Stephanie, listen, thank you so much for your time. It's very insightful. The top of the article has been cut off. It looks like The Independent. Is that correct or is it The Times?
Sorry, yes, it is the Independent.
The Independent. It looks like they're bold. And yeah. It's in there today, and it goes through a few bullet points. And I think it's food for thought, because as much as writing a letter to Santa, sometimes if you actually read the words and you can relate a little bit better than to hear them as well. So grab a copy or check it out online. But for now, Stephanie, thank you. Have a wonderful Christmas. I love your Christmas tree. It looks like it's very comfortable to hug, though you might not encourage me to do so.
On all of that. Thanks so much. And really nice to talk to you up there in Donegal. I have a super friend up there and love the place.
Lovely stuff. Thank you, Stephanie. Stephanie Regan there. Clinical psychotherapist. Again, if anything resonates with you and you want to share it with us, please get in touch. 086 60 25,000. Right, so we are running our competition. I need this tattooed on my forehead, this competition, because I've thrown away the information on it. But anyway, it's in association with our friends at Cadbury. Would you excuse me, please? And we're giving away a hamper a day, or Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, for someone who nominates someone special in their life. And the person that they nominate receives a wonderful Cadbury Secret Santa bar through the post. So it's winner, winner, chicken dinner, right? Okay, so some of the entrants so far, these may be winners, by the way, just because I read them out, it doesn't mean they're not still in the draw. But I just want to give you a sense of the love and affection that's out there for our fellow man and woman. I'd like to nominate my mum. She is and always will be there for me. I love her so much. That comes in from Mary. My special person is Beep. She glued my shattered pieces together with her magic glue. It's not every day you feel a real life angel. I nominate my brother for the Secret Santa. He is the best person I've ever met, and I'd be lost without him. During my dad's illness last year, my brother and I nursed him at home until he passed away. But without him being there with me through it all, this would not have been possible. And now our mum isn't well. And again, we're doing our best to care for mum at home. And without his help, I just don't think I could manage on my own. He's also a cancer survivor himself. Plus, he is a chocoholic. Hi, I'd like to nominate Mary. My son recently died by suicide, and this lady went over and beyond the call of duty, calling each and every day with gifts of flowers and chocolates. She's one in a million and has been my shoulder of strength. When my lovely daughter died tragically, people like Mary are very rare. Thank you. And can I also pass on my condolences and good wishes to you with the awful situation of the loss of two of your children? It must be terribly difficult, and you're clearly an incredibly strong person. So sorry, really, really sorry for everything you've been gone through and continue to go through, I'm sure, especially at this time of year. Our thoughts are with you, and I'll include you in my prayers. I'd like to nominate my husband after 4 years of treatment for a very rare disease. Yesterday was his first day medication-free. I would be giving him the hamper too. Thank you indeed. Okay. I would like to nominate my husband for the bar of chocolate. He really deserves it. He's been in a wheelchair for the past 20 years. He's an inspiration to everyone he meets and brings a lot of fun to the lives of others. He is my rock. And last one for now. Greg, I'd like to nominate my granddaughter for Secret Santa. She saved up all year to buy Christmas presents for children in an orphanage in Uganda. She also is sending stuff to Ronald McDonald House and does a shoebox appeal. She says she wants to make people happy at Christmas. I'm so proud of her, as her parents are, and I think she would be worthy of a Secret Santa. And she is just 6 years old. What an amazing young girl. Thank you for that, Mary. We really do appreciate it. We're continuing to take your nominations. You know, it's actually really warm, heartwarming, heartbreaking, and all different emotions reading some of those. Absolutely beautiful relationships people have with each other out there. And some amazing people doing amazing things. And what an opportunity to be able to thank them. So you still have time to enter. And re-enter, by the way. Send them in again tomorrow or Thursday, please. Don't just leave it today. And if you entered Monday, keep entering. And we'll go through them all, okay? But it's not. We have this Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So I don't want some of those brilliant stories to be lost today. Re-enter them tomorrow. There's no problem in doing that, okay? So send your reason, the person you're nominating, your name and address to 086 60 25,000. Your prize for nominating, if you're the successful nominator, is a Cadbury hamper. And the person you nominate will receive a Cadbury Secret Santa bar as well. I would say, though, you'll all end up tucking into it all together, perhaps. No, really busy on the phone lines today. Thank you so very much indeed. But also, I was contacted overnight by someone on social media, and their message reads as follows. My daughter has been sitting in the ED since 5 p.m. yesterday. It's now 2:45 a.m. It is busy, but nobody's been seen since 6 p.m. The doctors are calling out names that have already left and went home because they were waiting so long. The doctors have been told they've went home, and yet 10 to 20 minutes later, they're calling the exact same names and won't move on to the next person. It's really a joke down here. When she went up to ask why it was taking so long, she was told she was only in 9 hours and she'd just have to wait. There's also a baby here since 12 a.m. yesterday morning who still hasn't been seen. Greg, would you ask the Gardaí to bring the E&I junction at Burnfoot I'll have to look at that one again, Oisin. My apologies. Although I have no loving for government ministers usually, I'm sorry to say I have to agree with Charlie McConnell's comments today. In my opinion, the 9 till noon show should be renamed the Greg Hughes' Opinion Show. Okay, thank you for that. And that's perfectly fine too. Everyone's entitled to their opinion. I'm sorry if it comes across like that. I guarantee you it's not my intention, but I appreciate your comment, hence why I read it out. Why did Sinn Féin withdraw the motion of no confidence in Helen McEntee? Did they? I didn't hear that news yet. I've been in this studio. I presume because it's not going to pass if they did, in fact, withdraw it. I'm a HGV driver for 20 years. The average wage is €600 to €800 a week. It's a lot of commitment. No facilities, nowhere in Letterkenny to even get a sandwich and a cup of tea. Until this changes, nobody will want to come into the profession. We were chatting to a lady earlier on in the first hour of the programme, if you missed it, who's a very sad story of her house burning down. But at the same time, thankfully, her and her husband got out safe, and the cat as well, and a couple of treasured possessions. That poor lady, my heart goes out to her. We are not half thankful. Greg, I meet tractors all the time in the evening, and while it's great that they have great lights at the front, that would nearly blind you. There are very few lights on the back, and that's the real danger. I've spotted that myself. The road of the Donegal County Council was fixing a year ago and did cover one of them. You get water to put the fire out. A man uncovered it, and the County Council did come out to him and told him off for uncovering it. Okay. Greg, I was travelling from Newtown Cunningham yesterday and was approaching a school on my right-hand side, a few kilometres from Manor Roundabout. I slowed down to about 20 miles per hour. As I approached the school entrance gate, a woman with two children walked straight across the road in front of me. I had to slam on the brakes to stop and let her cross. I did not expect her to do that with such young children. This school's in a very dangerous location with no warning signs. On such main roads, red flashing lights should be erected a kilometre from the school during school hours. A school warden should also be employed. If I hadn't reduced my speed and approach, I dread to think what might have happened. We are always warning drivers to take care. The same warning should be applied to pedestrians. And we often do have people on with warnings for pedestrians, but I take your point. Thank you very much for that. Right, okay, Donna joins me now. Donna, how are you keeping?
I'm fine, thank you.
Okay, that's good. We were speaking a little earlier on, and perhaps naively was blown away by the fact that 83% of people with a guide dog or an assistance dog are refused entry to transport, hospitals, restaurants. What's your experience been? And it might be in relation to that or access and services, I don't know. Whatever you want to talk about, Donna.
Well, Craig, I came back home to Letterkenny 21 years ago, and one of my experiences here in Letterkenny was my husband was ill, so I live at the very top of the Long Lane, so I walked downtown with my guide dog to get his prescription and was getting some groceries, called a taxi at the Old Roots Chemist in the High Road, because that's where I knew where I was from when I had my sight. And I waited and waited for the taxi, and nothing came. Eventually, I'd smoked 3 cigarettes at this stage, and I rang the taxi firm back, and they apologised and says, "Oh, Donna, sorry, we were trying to get through to you, but we couldn't." Well, I'm not very good with a mobile phone. And she says, "Sorry, the taxi." I says, "What's happening to the taxi?" And she says, "And this is my regular taxi firm." Oh, she says, "The taxi man has refused to come and pick you up, Donna, because of your dog." And I was just in total shock. So I was very anxious at the time because it was near time. It was around 2:30. My children were coming home on the bus for 3 o'clock, and I needed to be there to pick them up because my husband couldn't. So I said to her, well, can you get me another one? She said, well, we're busy, Don, at the moment. But she says, I'll phone another company for you, which she did. And luckily enough, this other company came, High Road Cabs. And I was just told the man in the taxi at the time, I says, my God, I says, I can't believe it. I've been in England for the last 15, 16 years. And the only time I was refused a taxi was by an Asian driver that picked me up at the hospital. I says, I never thought this would happen in Letterkenny. And I was quite upset, to be quite honest. I was just shocked. I mean, I'm a Letterkenny girl, and I was just totally shocked. So that happened to me. And thankfully, they told me to go on the shop, Sean the Doc hour, and tell Sean the Doc. And Sean the Doc got it all sorted out. And a lot of other taxi drivers from Letterkenny did come up to my home place and apologise. On behalf of the other taxi driver who never, and is a local businessman, who actually never came to apologise.
Wow.
And I was totally in shock. But you walk down Letterkenny Main Street, and, I mean, I was born and reared here, but I only lost my eyesight 33 years ago. And you walk down Letterkenny Main Street. The main street itself is not too bad, but you try to get out to any of the outlets, and between footpathing and traffic lights that are for visual people only, they're the wee green man apparently is flashing up, but there's no bleeper on some of the lights here in the town. It's a large, very large town, but it's not built for anybody with a disability, not just blind people.
And you said that you said that you'd actually be reluctant to go into Letterkenny unless you were accompanied, or would you not go in at all?
I didn't get a guide dog after my last one died because I just thought, what's the point? Because I'm down there, people are shoveling me one way or the other. If it's not that, it's the footpaths, the long lane footpaths are absolutely desperate. So unless... I just decided, bugger it, and I just sit up here unless my husband takes me out, goes out shopping with me, or maybe now my daughters are older now, they were children at the time, I depend on them.
Yeah, but that's taken away. I mean, you've kind of been forced to or left in a position to forgo your independence because of the infrastructure of Letterkenny, effectively. Like, I mean, I know you retain your independence, but, you know, in terms of...
No, you're right, Craig. No, you're right, Craig. Since I've moved back here, I have lost all my independence because of the situation here in Letterkenny. If it's not being a taxi driver, which that was only one incident, been refused entry to a cafe, or just the road structure and the light structure alone. Yeah. Letterkenny is a very difficult place. I have myself lost my independence. I don't go out by myself anymore.
Yeah. Now, you talked about you being travelled and living elsewhere. Did you live elsewhere since you had lost your sight? And the reason I asked the question is to try and get a comparison maybe between all the places that you've been versus yeah. Letterkenny, or how do you sight when you returned home?
I moved to England in 1988. By 1989, I was having trouble with my eyesight. Mm. And although I'm a diabetic, I was diagnosed wrongly. And when the doctor realised what was wrong with me, I was bulimic. Everything was going okay. Until one day I went back in, I was getting laser treatment twice a week.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I went back into the hospital and my consultant wasn't there, so another junior doctor took over. And from that day to this day, I have never seen.
Wow.
And all that paper, my consultant admitted to the mistake, but I was only 23 at the time. And
didn't know the Lord. So what caused your sight loss, Donna?
It was actually me being bulimic. I'm also a diabetic, but it's nothing to do with the diabetes.
It was the bulimia.
Because I was bulimic at the time also.
And your sight almost went overnight?
My eyesight, I left work on a Tuesday, went into the hospital, and came home, and by Thursday my sight hadn't refocused.
Yeah.
Like, when you have laser treatment, you go all fuzzy anyway. And I went back into the hospital on the Thursday, and the doctor went, oh my God, he gave her too much treatment. And my husband was, well, we weren't married at the time. We were getting married the following month. And I said to the doctor, I said, what did you say? And he went, oh, I didn't say anything. I said, no, doctor, you spoke out loud. I may have gone blind, but I'm not deaf.
Mm.
And I had to fight the case. About 5 years later, I tried to take the case to court and was told I would lose my house and everything, trying to bring NHS to court. Story goes on. When I asked for my records, wanted to go to the Russian Eye Clinic. It's just a long story. The hospital disadvised me, told me I'm a diabetic, I could get infections, I could get this, and they knew. I just gone totally blind.
They circled the wagons. In terms of the laser treatment, what was that treatment for? Sorry, if it's not personal, Donna.
No, I understand. Well, as soon as you say you're a diabetic, to any doctor, everything's down to diabetes, which is wrong.
Yeah.
And it just wouldn't be the first time in my life that that has happened.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's always, oh, it's your diabetes, it's out of control, all this. And it was wrong. But I was young. They were telling me they were trying to save my eyesight. What had happened was, the night before, I was going to the pictures with my stepson.
Yeah.
And obviously, I'd just eaten, and I went upstairs, and I threw up like I usually do.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just didn't like food being in my stomach.
Yep.
I had to eat for the diabetes, but I wanted to throw it up at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I was stupid and didn't realise what I was doing. And I got this blob in my eye after I threw up. And I thought, oh God, what's wrong? It was now, looking out through my eyes, you couldn't see it looking at my eyes, but looking out through my eyes, it was like a little black tadpole running around my eye.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to my doctor the next day, explained, and he rushed me straight to Coventry and Warwick Hospital. And there, seen a consultant. Of course, he said, you're a diabetic. You've been a diabetic for so many years, 17 years it was at the time. And turned around and says, oh, it's down to diabetes, blah, blah, blah. So there was a new thing that came in then, that was 89. Was laser treatment. And it says, we'll give you this will save your sight. So I took doctors on the word, and I was getting the laser treatment twice a week, every week. And of course, then the doctor noticed one week, he says, have you been sick since I seen you last, Donna? So I explained to the doctor then that I had several years of just throwing up my food, which then he turned around and he says, you're bulimic. I didn't understand what the word meant at the time. And he explained to me. And he says, you do realise we've diagnosed you wrong. It's because you're a diabetic and the soft blood vessels, your blood vessels at the back of your eye are very soft.
Mm.
So every time you wrench, you're busting the blood vessel. And if you look over that over a matter of time, it's like he explained to me, like put a sheet of white paper in front of you and put a marker pen and put a black dot. For every time you do that, well, you're eventually going to cover that white sheet.
Yeah.
And you're going to go blind. So this is also to let young ones out there know, please do not go down the road sticking your fingers down your throat to try and lose weight.
Yeah.
It's not a good idea.
You would never have thought it. You would never have thought that would be a consequence of it. And listen, I know you described yourself as stupid, but you were a young person, and you know it's an illness in of itself as well. So I know it's not my place to say, Donna, but I don't think you were stupid. I just think it's some something that you were you had to endure as a young person. Listen, thank you for that and for the chat, Donna. You're an inspirational person. I appreciate you speaking to us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Craig.
God bless you, and best wishes to the rest of the family as well. Back with the weather. The winner of our Cadbury hamper today, and also a Secret Santa Cadbury bar as well. Good morning. This is the winner. Good morning. I'd like to nominate my daughter in November of a year. She saved my life after suddenly going into cardiac arrest. She dialed 999 and started CPR, which she only did as a short course in transition year in school. She saved her mum's life. And both of you are going to get those prizes. We're keeping the names quiet, so it is a surprise. Now, later on today at 12:30, it's the latest episode of Ours to Protect. We're looking at pre-loved Christmas to cut waste and hopefully costs. Aaron Murphy will give her guidance on one-off Christmas wardrobe pieces. And we also talked to a few people to get their opinion on pre-loved Christmas. There's a big thing with that now, whereby, you know, back in the day, it would be, you know, say a nice suit jacket or a dress at a ball or an event or a wedding or something. It used to be, oh yeah, this cost me 600 quid, this cost me whatever it might have been. Now, people go, oh, I bought this jacket here for, I got it for €5, or a dress, I got this for €8. It's great. That's the what the sort of modern way of, not boasting, but you know what I mean, talking about clothes is. For some, not for everyone, of course. Okay, listen, thank you very much for listening to the show. Thanks to those of you who watched the programme as well. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. But for me, Greg Hughes, Caroline Orr, who researched and produced, and Shannon working on the show today, have a wonderful Tuesday.